All right, we'll call the meeting order at 6:00. All right, we have Supervisor Yuhas, Supervisor Wambel, and Supervisor Poole, Supervisor here, Supervisor Burden Gasky are excused. Supervisor Adweski will be here, but we're going to wait. I don't see any citizens here, but would anyone else like to speak on behalf of some citizens that may not be here? We will close citizens' comments. Reports from the chair, I have none. The committee members have anything? All right, I have no communications. You know, did anyone have a chance to look at the minutes?
I will move the minutes.
Sorry.
Discussion? Hearing none, all in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye, opposed? All righty. You ready down there? You and I are sporting the haircut, same haircut today.
Grass doesn't grow on a busy street.
Jeff hasn't trimmed it.
I didn't trim it today.
He's got about 2 days worth going on there. So whenever you're ready, I'll let you get synced in and, you know, we talked about this for, I don't know, maybe 35 minutes at the last meeting. We didn't get through everything, obviously. That's why we're here again today, so. Andy was here, so I'm sure you guys probably talked to some degree as notes were made, different things that we talked about last time, so. If you can maybe just bring us up to speed first on the updates that were made from the last meeting.
Sure. So we actually had very limited discussion about the ethics code at the last meeting. I've not changed anything since the last meeting. The meeting before that, when we met in February, was when there were a number of more substantive changes. So the version that has circulated before has the changes tracked from that February meeting. This last meeting, I think the only thing that we really discussed in any, you know, larger detail was this concept of somebody living outside of their district. And whether that would be standalone ordinance, if there would be a requirement of signing an affidavit or a declaration attesting to their residence. And one of the things that we had talked about was ensuring, and there's state law that governs that. And so it was to ensure that in this ethics code where we incorporate state law, you know, one of the things I was going back to do was to verify whether that's incorporated within the ethics code. And so I've done that. And so if you have somebody that resides outside of their district and they continue to hold that office, traditionally that's prosecuted by the state under misconduct in public office, which is incorporated already in this. That's 946.12, and so if you go to line 278, 279 of the draft, 946.12 is already incorporated, so a violation of that would be also a violation of the ethics code. Another thing I'll flag though is that as I was researching this, I wasn't aware of it previously, so perhaps you aren't. If there's a belief that somebody resides outside of their district, state statute, excuse me, so I can check my notes. 8.28 provides a basis, it's not a criminal statute, but it provides a basis for anyone to make a verified complaint with the Attorney General. And so if anybody believes that anyone, whether it be local or state office holder, lives outside of their district, 8.28 provides a mechanism where somebody could make a verified complaint to the Attorney General, and then the Attorney General would investigate and prosecute it. So it's not, if it actually gets prosecuted as misconduct in public office. That's the actual state's code. But 8.28, unbeknownst to me, does provide a mechanism for anyone to make a complaint to the AG and forces the AG to investigate it. And then if there is something there, then to prosecute it under 946. something I learned as part of this process, so I thought I would share that. But for that, I think, you know, over the meetings that we've discussed this, I think we've covered the areas of concern or topics that everyone wanted to address, but I'm certainly happy to.
I'm gonna pause for a second. Supervisor Yasi, you brought that up originally, his explanation and how it's included in here, is that?
Adequate, yes.
Yeah, okay.
I appreciate the information.
Yeah, no, it is, I learned something.
That's my goal.
All right, well, why don't you go ahead and, I don't know, does anyone have any, before we get started, did anyone make any notes from the last time that came forward that they want to address before we get started? All right, Sam, why don't you go ahead and just walk us through a few things and then.
Sure, I mean, you know, so conceptually, the ethics code is adopting state law in certain areas and then providing for additional restrictions that aren't already as part of state law. And predominantly, that relates to section. Once we are at, sorry, my laptop is not cooperating. Subsection 4, once we get to line number like 72 or 73, special conflicts and standards of conduct enumerated, everything from in subsection 4 and all of those subsections underneath of it is really the meat and potatoes of what is unique to the municipal ordinance here as opposed to what's in state law. These sections are really spelling out the areas of, you know, with more specificity of what is truly a conflict of interest. What you can and cannot do. The other thing I'll highlight as part of this is that, there's variations with ethics codes in terms of, you know, there are some ethics codes out there that create an ethics committee or an ethics board. This ethics code does not do that. This ethics code provides that a complaint is made. This is for conduct that has already occurred. A complaint is made to the corporation counsel, unless the corp counsel is the subject of the complaint. And then the corp counsel has no discretion. The corp counsel has to refer to outside investigation, to outside counsel for investigation. And then from there, it would go to the district attorney for prosecution. At the very initial stages when this was in front of the executive committee, there was some debate and discussion as to, is that the way to go, or do you have an ethics board? And I think, my recommendation, certainly their determination at that time, was that we are better served by having a code that did not have an ethics board. When we see the ethics boards exist, they tend not to do anything, and they get dusted off once every year or two, right around election cycles. And people get complacent, people fall off of those boards. And to have a code, either way, that ethics board wouldn't have the ability to prosecute. You still have to rely on the district attorney's office for any formal prosecution. And so that's why it's my recommendation you use the corp counsel's office, you use outside counsel. That way, if there is something there, it's going to come after an investigation in a formal report. I think it's far more likely a district attorney would actually do something with it, as opposed to a board of the body taking some sort of action. So, those are the highlights, so to speak. So I don't want to just regurgitate and reread everything that's here. But the main points really start with, line number 72 in those subsections that come after, and then kind of the procedural side of it, I think, is important.
So there is a change on what we have here and what was given out at the last meeting. Well, on the other one, it was on line 13. It was just talking about any such complaint. The addition was any such complaint must be made in writing and provide any material, factual allegations in conjunction identifying the code provisions or state laws. We violated when the complaint is submitted. In the event the corporation counsel is subject to the complaint or request for legal opinion, the complaint request for legal opinion shall be presented to the county executive. The county executive shall refer the complaint outside counsel. Is that how this reads here? Which is different.
Yeah, so at line 317 here, and I think, Chair, this was in response to something you had raised at the meeting, perhaps all the way back in February,
yeah.
In terms of, you know, what does a complaint look like?
Right.
And we wanted to provide some specificity. We wanted it to be in writing. We wanted it to require that it include material factual allegations that you point to, whatever you think was violated. But we didn't want to go so far. I used an example. I'm aware of one county that requires that, you know, an ethics complaint be in writing, specify all this, plus it has to be notarized. And it just seemed like it was creating too many barriers,
too many hurdles,
for
yeah.
You know, John Q. Public to be able to make a complaint. So we tried to walk a line between, you know, protecting due process rights. You want to know if somebody is making a complaint, what is the complaint, have it be in writing so that the person can respond and it can be appropriately investigated, but at the same time not make it so onerous that, you know, a regular citizen who's not a lawyer is, you know, can know how to do it. And so, and then we added the provision that if the court counsel is the subject of the complaint, obviously that should be taken out of the hands of the court counsel then, and the goal was to put that into the executive branch of the county executive. It would be the same process. It would just be the county executive selecting outside counsel as opposed to court counsel.
Right. Okay. Does that say that in here? Because I'm looking at the one we had in March and the one that was here on the table, and I don't see that. Yeah, I'll just get here.
What should have been the version that should have been shared
this
in March.
This is what we have. Yeah, it's highlighted. What were the updates and changes?
Yeah, I think that's. Yeah. This is what I have.
Okay, you got the same thing.
Yeah. Yeah, so any such complaint made in writing.
Maybe I'm looking at the wrong one. Do you have that?
317.
Yeah. So it's slightly different than what this is.
So this is different.
Yeah. That's different than what he has and what we have. Or what was on the desks. Okay. All right.
If it's easier, I can read. I think I have the official version. If it helps, I'll just, it's a short paragraph. In situations where an act or omission contrary to this code or state law has already occurred, a complaint or request for a legal opinion may be to the corporation counsel. Any such complaint must be in writing or must be made in writing and provide any material factual allegations in conjunction with identifying the code provisions or state laws believed to have been violated. When such complaint is submitted, the corporation counsel shall refer the complaint or request for opinion to outside counsel for investigation and recommendations. In the event that the corporation counsel is the subject of a complaint or request for legal opinion, the complaint or request for legal opinion shall be presented to the county executive, and the county executive shall refer the complaint or request for opinion to outside counsel for investigation and recommendations. A complaint may also be made with the district attorney's office for review and potential prosecution consistent with section 19.11 of this code.
Do you have any questions on that part?
Yeah,
Can more supervisor know what's in here?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, go ahead with, if there's anything else you wanted to reference or?
That's all I have in terms of hitting the high points, so to speak.
I do have a question, because I'm not quite clear on, it's the penalty part, 415 is the line, I think.
Yeah, it starts at line 415.
Yeah, 415. So here's my question, I think we talked about this, but I don't recall exactly. It says, any action taken on behalf of Kenosha County and found to be in violation of this code may be reconsidered by Kenosha County Board of Supervisors and deemed void. Help me understand that part and how that plays into
Sure.
the bigger picture of things. Maybe I'm reading it without reading more in context before that, but that just sort of stood out to me.
Yeah, so the intent of that line is, and it's probably easier to highlight it with an example. The intent of that provision would be, let's say the board takes some sort of official action, ratifies a contract. And unbeknownst to anyone on the board, one of the supervisors who votes on that has a material conflict of interest that went undisclosed, right? Let's use an absurd example, they're getting a kickback, right? And no one knows it at the time, but sometime after the contract is ratified, that comes to light, it's investigated. Clearly, you know, receiving a kickback would be a violation of the ethics code. But at this point, the county board has already ratified the contract. And perhaps it was unanimous. Nobody, or you're already beyond the ability to bring a motion to reconsider or anything like that. This provision would allow you to essentially go back and nullify that vote. That's really the intent of it, is so that in the event there's a violation of the ethics code that's learned after the fact, it gives you, and that's not required, but it would give the board, the county, the ability to invalidate that prior action, even if your governing rules may not allow you to do it, because it's already been, oftentimes like a motion to reconsider needs to be brought in the next committee cycle. And so let's say that time has come and gone, this would give you the ability to go back and take action that your rules would otherwise allow.
So would that sort of that same scenario apply to someone who's not on the county board and say they were a department head or something like that, and there was business that was going through that department head and they influenced where the business went? Would the county board have that same ability, or would that be handled in a different way?
What this section is really relying on is any action taken on behalf of Kenosha County and found to be in violation may be reconsidered by the board and deemed void. So if the misconduct occurred with staff, and based on that misconduct, the board took some sort of action, then yes, I think as long as the board takes an action, if it's a board item, then the board can nullify it.
Okay.
If something occurs with staff that never makes it to the board, it's not something that would be, approved or refused by the board either way, then this provision wouldn't apply.
Okay.
This provision relies on the fact that there is some board action, and it gives the board the ability to go back and void its prior action.
Okay. I'm sure you know this, we're combining the elected officials and the employees into one ethics ordinance now. So that's why I'm just asking. So are there any other instances in here where something may or may not apply based upon the combination of these two ordinances now?
I don't know that I follow that.
So like in here, So like in that same example, say we didn't have to vote on it, but then say 6 months later, after we're halfway through a whatever it is that this guy person was getting a kickback on, that didn't have to be approved by the county board, what would be the corrective action or the ethics violation in that case then?
So everything that's in this is, in this code is applicable to elected officials and to staff. So if it would be a violation of the ethics code for a county supervisor to do A, B, and C, it is a violation of the ethics code for a member of staff to do the same thing.
There wouldn't be like a vote to reconsider to nullify a contract, right? Because if they're halfway through it and then we find out, that's why I'm just curious what that corrective action might be, or like how someone would file that.
So let me kind of put an example out there.
Okay.
If you have a staff member who, I'm trying to think of something that a staff person could do to bind the county that doesn't come through the county board. And I'm having a difficult time coming up with an example.
Oh, contracts.
Typically the board approves the budget as a whole, and then within those budgetary parameters, the departments or the administration has a fair amount of discretion in terms of negotiating and entering into contracts.
Okay.
I suppose theoretically, my thought would be if you had a situation where, say for example, a department head was later found to be engaged in, as you said, a kickback, certainly I think that would be grounds to undo that contract. And more importantly, there's the second half of the provision that Attorney Hall was just talking about, talks about parties found to have violated county ethics ordinances or policies may be prohibited from doing business with the county for a period not to exceed 5 years. So I think there would be remedies potentially on the table in a situation like that if that determination was made after the fact.
And would some of these, these ethics apply to the contracted employees we have as well that are in the hundreds for the county?
I'm looking over at HR Director Capital. My recollection is, and she's about to leave the room. My recollection is that I do believe, and again, I don't want to say definitively, but I think generally speaking, when we sign contracts with an agency that's going to provide contracted employees, I do think there's a provision in there that holds them to various county standards. They have their own, obviously, but I don't remember whether the ethics policy is one of them.
So, as an ordinance, I would defer to Corporation Counsel, but generally when we're contracting with companies and utilizing employees through a contract, we have all of that outlined in that agreement, in that contract. The day-to-day policies and procedures, generally they have to follow those contracted employees. As an ordinance, that's where I would.
Yeah, I mean, the ordinance itself defines county employee as a person filling an allocated position of county employment. So on its own, this ordinance would not apply to a contractor because it's not an allocated position with the county. I think you could, by virtue of contract with the contractor, say, you know, by entering into this contract, you are voluntarily agreeing that you're going to comply with all of our ordinances, including the ethics code. I think by contract that you could do that. I worry a bit about, in the absence of that, I don't know how far your code can stretch out. You can clearly govern the conduct of your elected officials, certainly your employees. I think once you're outside of the context of your employees, you would need that contract provision to say, you know, we're agreeing that we're gonna comply with all of these rules and these ordinances. And if they agree to that, well then, you can do it, you can enforce it.
Right.
But I don't know that you can reach that without having that agreement with them, without the contractor agreeing to accept those terms.
Got a thought? Supervisor Pearson?
Brian, when I was working here, and Patty, you might remember, and this was something the purchasing division handled, they had ethics requirements in our contracts, and you look at all those contracts, so we do have that. But my recall is that is not, was not part of, in the scope of the ethics code, that's my recall. And those contracts apply to, you know, if we're buying material or if we're contracting with an agency to provide manpower support, which, you know, as an independent contractor. So that, but my recall is we did that by contract, but not through that ethics code. And the ethics code, we actually had, like we all, you all know, we had two different ones, one for the employees and one for the elected, for some of the elected officials. And that's what those policies applied to, not to the contracts. But again, we put language in the contracts that bound them to ethics requirements. That's
so something to this or similar is already in a lot of it. Like I'm thinking of Brookside with the food services and, you know, human services with the DCFS and all the social workers and, you know, wherever else we have basically full-time employees that are, you know, even within the finance, you know, we have people that are full-time here that honestly, they probably know more about what's going on in the county than a lot of other people do that work here as well in their slice of what they do. You know, so they would have proprietary information that they could use in a lot of different ways, I'm guessing, right? I just think there should be something, because there's, I don't know what the number is, but there's probably at least 200 full-time contract employees in the county. I don't think it's probably beyond the scope of this, which I agree, but there should be some kind of language that is similar to this, because we wouldn't want a contracted employee guiding business to a family member that, like, if you or I did that, it would be a violation of this code.
In the contract.
Right.
Yeah.
Brian, I mean, we just updated the purchasing policy. I can't remember if it has ethics requirements in it, but that's probably where that would land. You know, that our purchasing
policy. Yeah, off the top of my head, I don't know. But I mean, again, I feel pretty comfortable that we're covered in this instance.
Yeah. I mean, those contracts would typically have, you know, non-discrimination clauses, non-conflict of interest. That, you know, that would be pretty standard.
Those were my questions and notes from the last meeting we didn't get to. I don't know if anyone else has. Supervisor Yates.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Under 19.06-1, now I'm working off of this copy, which I think is the most.
That was one from the last meeting that he's looking at. Sam's looking
yep,
at it.
That's well. The one. So not the one that's on the table.
Yeah.
Under section 3. Where it states that in the event that corporation counsel is the subject of a complaint or request for legal opinion, the complaint or request for legal opinion, line 320 through 21, shall be presented to the county executive, and the county executive shall refer the complaint or the request for opinion to outside counsel for an investigation and recommendation. Don't you think there should be a time frame on that? Because I don't want to see a complaint sitting on a desk for months.
Yeah, we did discuss that at the
yes,
last
we
meeting.
Did.
And that was literally as we were walking out the door.
Yeah.
I think
we decided it was going to be aspirational.
Yeah.
and I remember commenting about how lawyers hate that. I think that makes sense. I think putting a deadline for the in either event, for the corporation counsel to secure outside counsel or for the county executive to do it, I think is reasonable. And it's a matter of adding a couple of words.
It's 20 days.
20-30 days seems perfectly, you know.
Yeah, are you able to acquire lawyers, specialized counsel in that amount of time sometimes, or are there availability issues?
Certainly within 30 days, and we could also build in language to effectively say that this has to be done within 30 days, or there needs to be a report that's a lot. You know, if there is a truly unique or bizarre situation where, you know, every lawyer in town has a conflict and can't take this on, for then at least there to be some accountability of, you know, reporting back and saying, hey, here's what the problem is. So, you know, I would say, you know, providing a 30-day deadline to refer to outside counsel or to report back as to why, or to, you know, issue a report to the county board as to why, would be a reasonable.
Do I need to make amendments to do so, or can we just?
I can't remember how we were doing the other adjustments. I think we just all sort of agreed that that would be acceptable.
Unless there's any objection.
Yeah, we don't need a motion or anything like that. I just think, does that, the 30 days sound reasonable to everybody?
Do we have to differentiate between business days and weekends? 30 days works?
Typically, with statutory interpretation, if it's something like 30 days, it's 30 days. Okay. When you start doing like 5 days or 3 days, then it will be interpreted as you would be. But when you're using 30 days, 30 days, 30 days.
Yeah. With the clause that if it's unattainable, they have to require a report to the county board?
Yes, so what I would suggest is we go to like line 319, when such a complaint is submitted, the corporation counsel shall refer the complaint or request for opinion to outside counsel for investigation within 30 days.
Or submit a report?
Or submit a report to the county board.
If I may, I'm not opposed to that, but I mean, my one concern is the, in the past couple of years, requests made to my office for, I'll call it complaint or investigation, have been made very publicly. Not passing judgment one way or another, but they have. They've been made at public meetings or by virtue of an email sent to the entire board. I can see scenarios where somebody may submit a complaint more quietly, and I don't know if I want to notify the entire county board, who may not be aware of the existence of that complaint. Unless the idea is that we're going to report everything to everybody, but.
Well, isn't the county board, though, just to be notified if it's not acted upon in 30 days?
Agreed, but what I'm saying is, even then, my concern is I'm then revealing the existence of the complaint right. That may not otherwise be known, and the first time anyone knows about it on the board is when I'm reporting that it couldn't be referred out within 30 days. I'm not opposed. I'm just saying that's the concern I have as I'm sitting.
There could be something really sensitive there with some privilege involved, and you're inadvertently making it public.
I'm not trying to get out either my office or the exec's office from the responsibility of making sure that it's done. I'm just trying to figure out what the best way to do that is, particularly when you're dealing with potentially sensitive information.
Yeah, some thoughts, Steve.
Thanks. So, Joel, but you're not conflating, I mean, if I turn something into you, I have a right to confidentiality, right?
You mean about yourself, or?
I can come to you, so you're saying in this case, you would have to advise me that the confidentiality does not apply. So if I filed a written document with you about something I'm concerned about, which might not necessarily be anything, but could be something, I thought I had a right to confidentiality on that.
I think typically that's the case. I think that's partly what I'm saying I'm concerned about is that, yeah. Let's say that you file a complaint regarding another supervisor. Number one, I'm not sure what. Well, I'm going to put that aside. My concern is that under what's being contemplated right now, and again, I understand we're kind of workshopping it, but what's being contemplated right now is 30 days down the road, if for some reason I haven't been able to get an attorney on it. And maybe the whole point is that it's to provide really, really powerful incentive for me to make sure I can get an attorney on it, or the county executive. But my concern is that then I am reporting to the entire board. A complaint has been received. I've been unable to retain counsel to handle it, period. Even if that's all I say, I'm going to be getting questions from people as to what it's about, what's concerning, and my saying I can't tell you, while accurate, is not going to go over real well. Maybe it's a point of reporting back to the complainer or the maker of the complaint. Probably sounds better. I don't know. I'm not trying to defer responsibility or duck the idea of having some kind of incentive. I'm just trying to figure out the best way to structure it so it doesn't put the office in a further difficult position.
My thought was similar to what you said, is that you have to be referred back to the complainant saying, yes, we've taken care of this in stage 22 and it's moving forward as, you know, as our procedures would be, and they would be the only person that would know. You would have to report back to them, and then if they wanted to make it public, I guess that would be up to them at that point if there's that confidentiality. But yeah, I think that's the best.
I mean, that seems like a really reasonable approach, because yeah. Then the complainant holds the cards at that point,
right?
You know,
and then maybe if he doesn't hear back in 30 days, then the next level would be is that you can go to county board chair or the county executive if he doesn't hear back within 30 days. I mean, there has to be something that complainant can do if he doesn't hear back in 30 days, right? There has to be, and then if, you know, whoever the corporate counsel might be, there might be another complaint against the corporate counsel for not doing what they were supposed to do within the 30 days.
I've seen that before.
Yeah, you know, so. Is there any other thoughts on that? I mean, that was a good point you brought up to get this conversation.
Well, I've been slow rolled before, so I know what it's like to have something sit for months and not be addressed, even though you're told it's being addressed.
Yeah.
And that's why when I was reading through this, I'm like, you know, that's a major loophole. It could sit there for months.
Yeah.
Oh, I appreciate
and no
that.
One would know. Yeah.
Yeah. Brian, I really liked your idea, and this seems to be with Monica's too, that it goes back to the complaint, the one that filed the complaint. That would make sure like it doesn't get slow rolled, you know.
So how between Sam and Joe, how would you guys like that worded best? What that appropriate language would be in there?
I have a draft. So when such a complaint is submitted, the corporation counsel shall refer the complaint or request for opinion outside counsel for investigation and recommendations within 30 days, or if outside counsel is not retained within that time period, provide an explanation to the complaint.
Do we need to add anything if the complainant isn't informed within 30 days of what they can do, what that next step would be? I don't know if it should or not. I'm just throwing it out there.
Yeah, I don't think so. I mean, you're imposing an obligation on the corp counsel or the county executive to do one of two things, either secure outside counsel or report back to the claimant or the complainant that has not occurred, and here's why. And if the corporation counsel or county executive refuses to do either one of those, well, then they're violating the ordinance.
Right.
Because we're using shall language here, that they're obligated to do one of those two things within 30 days. So I don't think you need to provide any further. It's they're violating the ordinance if they don't do one of those two things, if they don't get counsel or provide an explanation within 30 days. What the complainant does, so let's say counsel is not secured in 30 days and court counsel goes to the complainant and says, I've not been able to secure outside counsel and here's the three reasons why. What the complainant does next is really kind of unlimited to some extent. So I wouldn't put into code what they can or cannot do. They can go to the press, they can go to the board, they can do any number of things. The point being, though, is that they're provided that knowledge within 30 days so that they can make an informed decision about what they're doing.
Does anyone have any comments on what he just added to that ordinance, to that section? Does that sound agreeable to everybody?
And then I would replicate that same exact language in the provision where we talk about what the county executive is. So the sentence I read related to the corporation council securing outside counsel, will say the same exact thing with the county executive.
Good catch. Anyone else has a thoughts on this? Yes, sir.
I know I didn't want to usurp the committee, but if all the questions are asked, I had a couple of questions.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So would it be appropriate to get an executive summary along with this document? Would that be okay? About the changes that an executive summary that went to the board along with the document when we were approving.
I will defer to Attorney Paul.
Sure. I mean, I can certainly. Are there any particular areas that you want me to focus on? I mean, when I've done executive summaries, it's been because we got a 100-page document.
Key changes.
Yeah. So I think I could do a memo. I mean, first and foremost, structurally, we went from two.
But that's a good example.
Yeah, I mean, so I think we can start with that, and then, you know, in a memo kind of outline.
And then for full disclosure, I had a meeting with the attorneys on this some time ago, and I raised some of the incidents that occurred, like the incident with the payroll, the incident with the festival. I won't mention the name of the festival, but and you put language in there that gave the ordinance a bit more clout. Can you advise that you would have a little bit more clout from an ethics standpoint to enforce action if those incidents occurred? Can you remind the committee of what that language was? You remember that?
I certainly remember the conversation, and I remember including that language. Yeah, so line 222, thank you, Joe. Falsifying claims or records, no elected county official or county employee shall intentionally or recklessly engage in submitting any falsified claim and knowingly false document. And so the language in this provision is much more broad than the prior ethics code. So the ethics code required intentional conduct, which can be difficult to prove. This still says intentional, but we've added reckless so that even if somebody says what you didn't know, somebody else did it. It effectively allows you to prosecute even if someone is pleading ignorance.
That was pretty, I think, significant, because when we looked at the cases that occurred before, the word intentional carried a lot of weight as far as the dismissal without any repercussions on those incidents. So adding reckless was pretty significant and pretty beneficial, I thought, for the ethics board. And then I've had significant discussions about fraud, and I've decided to back off on the fraud, so I'm backing off on the fraud. But as long as I have the two attorneys here in the meeting, we have a little more time. In my next term, I want to bring policy in on fraud, which you have advised that it should be a separate policy and not embodied in this document. And the idea that I had, and that there's when I was here running the audits, there was a thing called, I think, SAS 92, Statement of Auditing Standards 92, a thing that no one here would ever want to have to live with at all, except I suffered with it and Patty suffered with it. But what it does do is it requires all fraud to be reported to the county, that's the administrator. So all fraud, and there was no de minimis amount, all fraud had to be reported to the county, and I was hoping that it could be put into here, but you rightfully advised me that it should not go into this ethics code. You were right to advise me that it should not. So thank you for helping with that. But I would like to bring policy in that does that. Is there a best practice dealing with this issue, or some experience you have dealing with this fraud issue, reporting it? Because really, I'd like everything to get reported to the executive and the finance committee, because this is fiscal fraud in a closed session. I want the transparency and disclosure in a closed session of all fraud, similar to what is required in auditing standards. Can you advise the committee on that concept and what would be a good next step when I start working on this next term?
I mean, I've seen ordinances, local ordinance governing fraud and providing for whistleblower protections, things like that. And that was really what led to my recommendation that be treated separately than this, because those ordinances tend to be pretty significant by themselves in terms of identifying what is fraud. It seems silly, but it needs to be defined. Providing reporting requirements, basically to say that if you're aware of fraud and you don't report it, that in and of itself is a violation of the law. And then to provide whistleblower protection from a personnel standpoint, to build into the ordinance that you won't be subjected to discipline or termination for reporting fraud. There are they do vary, but I have seen local ordinances governing fraud, and I think what I would suggest, rather than entirely reinventing the wheel, is to pull a couple of those from other municipalities, both in Wisconsin and outside of Wisconsin, and see if that kind of spurs some thought as to where to start.
Yeah, there's this organization. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for letting me have this discussion. If I get out of line, you'll let me
know. I'll throw something at you.
There's this organization called Government Finance Officers Association that has best practices, and maybe they might have a template on this too. But again, I want to do something smart, not something that is just is a mess, you know, that just has like, you know, all. So, and I think this process looked pretty good. So I think we'll end up with a pretty good policy that isn't some act of craziness. And the same thing I would like to this broad policy.
And I would add that in this code, I was looking for it, that starting on line 242, we do include an obligation to report fraud. So any elected county official or county employee with actual knowledge of fraud or other illegal activity conducted by an elected county official or county employee must report such activity or conduct to the Office of Public Counsel as soon as practical. What you're talking about is far more robust, and I think important, but we do have a provision that would make it an ethics violation to not report.
And I thank you for that. That is another significant improvement, I think, in policy that didn't exist prior, am I right?
Correct. That was all.
Those are my questions. If I bring in a policy, I may look for supported co-signers on it. So if anyone's interested when I start working on it, I'll reach out to others. But I yield. So.
Perfect. Thank you.
On the falsifying claims or records.
What line? Like point into a line number.
On the thing I have, it's 227. Okay. That was sitting here when I got here. You were just talking about this. You brought it up, Supervisor Gearson. No elected county official or county employee shall intentionally recklessly engage in submitting any falsified claim or knowingly false document. Supervisor Uhas had a question at our previous meeting regarding the date for the address. If somebody submitted any document that had maybe a false address on it, would it apply here as an ethics violation?
I think it could, and I think we let off the meeting discussing this point. So I think that's right. I think if there's a, the issue with the residency can come up with somebody that's moving in the midst of a term, right? And if they're not having to submit, clearly if you put an incorrect address on nomination papers on your disclosure forms, but you only have to file those at, you know, at periodic points. So if somebody submitted an incorrect address on one of those documents, then yes, that's falsifying the record. But when it comes to residency, first of all, it gets prosecuted when there is a violation. It gets prosecuted under misconduct in public office, which we do incorporate into this. So Wisconsin Statute 946.12 prohibits that. That statute is incorporated by reference into the code. And then also I pointed out, I think it was 8.02, is a statute that I actually just came across when I was looking into this. It actually has a process where any individual can make a verified complaint to the Attorney General if they believe somebody is living outside of their district,
okay,
whether it be state or local. And that statutory mechanism forces the Attorney General to launch an investigation, potentially declare the office vacant, and then if it gets prosecuted under 946.
Right, I just thought that was maybe somewhat applicable on several different channels to work
around.
Does anyone else have anything? So if someone wants to make a motion to approve as we've amended.
Second.
Is there any further discussion? All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? All right. Okay, is there anything else anyone would like to bring up? Joe, Sam, Patty, Claire.
Thanks for being a good chair.
Is there a different one?
You guys need the same one.
Okay. Yeah, I'm asking you to get scrambled and find it.
You did.
So no one leaves until you get your sign. And if there's a motion to adjourn.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Thank you all very much. If there was a bar this close, I'd buy everybody a beer. Maybe it's a BYOB county board meeting tonight. Other people bring water to drink and sodas. And that would be interesting. Everyone's got a shot.
Yeah, right. Well, we got to add a line. Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Oh. I'm a month away from my grandpa.
Is that right?
Both my kids moved back to town, so I'm good there. I'm all set. You're ready to go.
Grandpa daycare.
They call. Well, that's the double-edged sword. My daughter moved back from Oak Creek to Kenosha. She bought a house in Forest Park. I spent 3 weeks almost straight over there painting, which I didn't mind doing, but.